Canadian novelist Michael Christie used to be a professional skateboarder. He's also worked with people with mental illnesses. Somehow, he combines the two in the story of a boy named Will, whose mother is so scared of everything, she doesn't let him leave the house for about a decade. They rename the rooms of their house, Paris, Cairo, Toronto, so that it maps out an entire world for them. Michael Christie was in Australia recently, where he spoke to me about his novel, If I Fall, If I Die. Tell us about Will's world. It stretches from Cairo to New York at quite an easy pace, but where is this place?
This is a world within a world. Will is a 10-year-old boy who's grown up most of his life inside his house with his mother, Diane, who is severely agoraphobic woman. She's a sort of reclusive, experimental filmmaker, and they live in the house and don't really leave, and they order in food, and they kind of, it sounds perhaps dreary, but they actually sort of create this magical world of art and cooking and crafts, and so they really fill up their time with wonder. And the novel is about Will's transition out of this world, and so on the very first page of the novel, Will steps outside for the first time in his life, and the book is everything that ensues after that.
You describe it as a place full of wonder rather than thinking of it as one full of fear.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say it's been created by fear, though?
I think so. It's certainly bounded by fear. It's bounded by Diane's fear, and also Will's sort of adapted her kind of worldview as well, without her actually telling him to. I think the children of mentally ill parents often just sort of intuit the rules of the system that they're growing up in, and Will certainly has done that, though he wouldn't be able to describe it necessarily.
How would you describe him as a character?
He's an interesting boy. I mean, I've always been a big fan of coming of age fiction. And I always felt like there was some aspects of boyhood that aren't always captured. And so Will's very naive, yet he's absurdly confident, I think you could say. He's sort of fierce, but yet he's also very, very vulnerable. He's creative. He's the kind of kid you would expect from growing up, you know, that would be created by a situation like this. I mean, I think I actually drew a lot of inspiration for Will from Calvin and Hobbes, which may seem like an interesting, it's sort of source material, but it's the greatest comic of all time. It's a boy and his tiger and his imaginative world that he creates. It was a huge influence on me growing up, and so there's a lot of Calvin in Will, as well as other Dickens characters and stuff like that.
To get more of a sense of that early world and that early voice, mm-hmm, of Will, because as you say, he does change and develop during the novel. Could you just read something from the very beginning of the book for us?
Absolutely. The boy stepped outside, and he did not die. He was not riddled with arrows, his hair did not spring into flame, and his breath did not crush his lungs like spent grocery bags. His eyeballs did not sizzle in their sockets, and his heart's pistons did not seize. No barbarian lopped his head into a blood-soggy wicker basket, and no glinting ninja stars were zinged into his throat. Actually, incredibly, nothing happened. No immolation, no bloodbath, no spontaneous asphyxiation, no tide of shivery terror crashing upon the shore of his heart, not even a trace of his mother's black lagoon in his breath. Somehow, Will was calm. The day's bronzy light, shredded by a copse of birch, tossed a billion luminous knife blades onto the front lawn, and he dared to continue down the walk, where he'd watched hundreds of delivery men stride to their house, bearing fresh food for them to eat and new clothes for them to wear, with the paving stones granular and toilet bowl cool under his naked feet. Venturing out into the unreal arena of his front yard for the first time in his memory, he discovered only early summer crispness in the air. This outside air, its breeze slaloming through the jagged wisps of his cut-off shorts, in and out of the straps of his helmet. Will had felt this same air sweep through the window in New York on those rare occasions he opened it, despite how it worried his mother. But something was sapped when it came through. He never immersed himself like this, not since his memory got impressionistic and gauzy as if it had been transcribed by a stenographer in full Black Lagoon.
Where to go and what to do?
There's a lot of film history and film references in this novel. Diane was a filmmaker, so she has these quite interesting ways of looking at the world. But it was always a scary, chaotic place for her, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Diane is someone who grew up in unreasonably tragic circumstances, and she's a woman who's seen a great deal of loss, but a woman who also derived a great strength from that loss and managed to, for a time anyway, to really go out into the world and create these wonderful works of art and to be sort of a singular kind of artist. And so the fabric of film is very much ingrained in the book, and it's a big part of the story.
As you say, she'd gone out in the world, and there's a lot of insides and outsides in the novel. But when we meet Will and his mother, they're back in this little town of Thunder Bay. Mm-hmm. It's a brutal place. Describe Thunder Bay for us.
Thunder Bay is also the name of the city that I grew up in, but this is certainly a more stylized version of it, though it is accurate. I mean, it's on the Great Lakes in Canada. It's Lake Superior, which is the second largest freshwater body in the world. It's sort of like a little ocean, and it was at one time it was the biggest grain shipping port in the world. So it was sort of, there's these giant castles of grain elevators down by the water, and I grew up with those there, and by the time I arrived, most of those were empty because it's a place that underwent a serious decline in the 60s-70s. And so it's kind of a gothic place in some ways. It's a fearsome place, it's a harsh place, and it's a world that Will is not ready for in his move from the inside to the out. The grain dust is something that I grew up with. Actually, the rates of asthma in a place like that are, I think it's 10% higher just from the dust in the air that is there. And it just seemed like such an interesting metaphor for, you know, the way that the world can invade us and the way that the outside can come inside of our bodies and cause a kind of havoc. So yeah, it's very much a working class place, which is the place, you know, that's my upbringing. So
Will does decide to step out into the world. He encounters another boy, he's intrigued, but he seems so vulnerable. He's both full of wonder, and you really don't want him to go into the brutality of a classroom.
And I mean, I myself had a somewhat rough adaptation to the world of school. I really didn't fit there, and I had trouble, you know, just with academic stuff and just trouble paying attention, and I just wanted to be at home reading, kind of thing. So I mean, I drew a lot of that experience from my own experience with school, which wasn't as extreme as Will's, but I mean, I think for a lot of Will's sections, the reader kind of occupies the place of Diane in sort of observing him, and I think the reader cares for Will fairly early on, and so, you know, we have to watch him go out, and, you know, like all parents, you have to see your beloved venture into the dangers of the world, and you have to trust them, and you have to let them fall.
And I think that's the cleverness of your writing. We know that she's living in an extreme version of this, but particularly when he's first stepping out into the world, you're sort of on her side. It is dangerous. There are terrible things out there, and he's not ready for them.
And I think that was a big part of why I wanted to write this book. I didn't want to just portray agoraphobia as an unreasonable sort of affliction that we, you know, that we all know is absolutely incorrect. I mean, it is, any parent will tell you, and I certainly learned this when I became a parent. It is terrifying. You know, the world is dangerous, and there are things to fear. And a lot of the time it's separating out what we ought to avoid and what we ought to invite, that is the very difficult part of living.
And one of the things that Will has to understand is this deep divide in the town. Mm-hmm. So there is a boy who is at first an absence in the classroom, Jonah. But when he then encounters him, Jonah doesn't speak in the classroom. Why not?
Jonah is an Indigenous boy. He's Anishinaabe, which is the First Nation that is in Thunder Bay mainly, and that I grew up with. And yeah, Jonah is an important character for me. He's someone that I really needed to write. I think he's someone who's very creative. He's very similar to Will in that he's marginal and he is strange and he doesn't necessarily fit in. And he sort of retreated within himself. He's sort of made an inside in his own self. And you know, it takes Will to sort of draw him out, and they form a friendship in their marginality.
That terrible divide, though, that mm-hmm. the extent of the racism that yeah. you show in the town, why was it important for you to write about that?
I mean, I grew up with that omnipresent racism. And, you know, I think particularly in Canada, I'm not sure about Australia, but I do know that it is present. But in Canada, a lot of it is work-based, which I always found very, very, very strange. And so it's particularly in my hometown, it's like the old, absolutely false stereotype that Indigenous people don't work, they're on the public support, and they don't pay taxes, and blah, blah, blah. And so most of the ire and stupidity, frankly, is based on that. And so I grew up with that.
Will and Jonah end up on a quest. I mean, it really is a quest. There are maps, there are wolves, there's danger, there's all sorts of things going on. What are they looking for?
They're looking for another boy. He's sort of the first boy that Will encounters, and Will only meets him once. And his name is Marcus, and he's another Indigenous boy who is imperiled. And so they eventually end up on a kind of search for him. And I think it's a search for Marcus, but it's also a deeper search for Will and Jonah as well. They're trying to make the world better. They're trying to find a better world, a world that doesn't just swallow up boys and make them disappear. There's a long sort of scary history in Canada of missing and murdered Indigenous people and people that the government aren't and the police aren't necessarily concerned with finding.
Can we just go back to one of the characters in your novel we haven't spoken about? And for ease of the plot, we'll call him the Whispering Man. He is a character who is full of wordplay and literary references, and at times he's incomprehensible, and at times he's speaking in this really interesting pastiche that you do understand. Mm-hmm. How did you create his voice?
He just came to me. I mean, I did previously worked in mental health. I worked in a psychiatric hospital for a period of time. I also worked in a homeless shelter in sort of Vancouver's roughest neighborhood that was specifically for people who are suffering from severe mental illness. So, and you know, he's somewhere on that spectrum. I never really pinned him down as to what particular disorder the Whispering Man has, but he's certainly someone who is experiencing some disruption of his mental state. He's also a person, as you learn in the book, who's experienced a great deal of tragedy. But his language, and working in a psychiatric hospital, you know, you'll hear things that sometimes, you know, I would hear a client of mine just say something that was profoundly beautiful, right butted up next to something that was profoundly disturbing or profoundly scary or profoundly silly. And so there was this linguistic playfulness there that I always appreciate in literature. I think we often can be too bounded by by sort of the fear of looking silly or the fear of playing with words. And so, you know, that Irish tradition of just going for it and making up language and inventing things and playing. It was great fun to write him.
Because the feel of the book changes about halfway through as this sort of mystery and adventure side kicks in. But part of the way it moves is through this beautiful, graceful sweeping through urban landscapes on skateboards.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about skateboarding as a type of poetry. What does it mean to you?
It means a great deal. I mean, it's interesting to... I started skateboarding in, you know, when I was 10 years old, and I did it for most of my life. I eventually was a professional skateboarder for a period of time. I wrote for skateboard magazines. I traveled around the world doing it. And for me, it was very much a creative on-ramp. It was a way for me to get into film and get into photography and writing. And it, for a kid growing up in a situation like that, there aren't a lot of those on-ramps. And it really kind of fostered a creativity in me. And so I always knew that I wanted to try to write about skateboarding in a literary way, in a way that really appreciated its beauty. Because I do think it, and you know, it's not uniquely beautiful, but I think it's a gorgeous thing, and I knew that I could do it.
It seems to remake the landscape for these boys. Is that what it does for you?
This is another thing that I love about skateboarding, is that it is unbounded. There's no rink, there's no field. It is something that takes place in public space, and it is something I always love to say that the one thing that poor young people have, in particularly in the first world, is a lot of pavement. And so if you think about it that way, it's this wonderful adaptation of you know, young people to take this often decaying urban environment and to repurpose it and to make it artistic and to make it into a playground. And I think that's one of the great magic tricks that skateboarding accomplishes.
Wasted hours that you make new and turn into
And while Michael Christie finds poetry in the movement of a skateboard on concrete, it turns out he lives on an island off Vancouver now, and there's hardly a footpath to be found. If I Fall, If I Die is published by William Heinemann.